Welcome to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Monday and Friday, and Jim Fetzer during the middle 3 days of the week on the Dynamic Duo. I am Morgan Reynolds, your guest host, this Thursday of September 25, 2008. And today I think I've got a terrific lineup. During the first hour, we speak with Bob Murphy, PhD economist, about the meltdown, the financial, the fiscal crisis. And then during the second hour, I have 9/11 experts, aviation experts, John Lehrer and Joseph Keith. Now, my first guest here, I want to welcome aboard Robert Murphy. He earned his PhD in economics from New York University. He taught at Hillsdale College for 3 years. He worked with Arthur Laffer's investment and research firm, and now he's a senior fellow with the Pacific Research Institute, and he runs the website consultingbyrpm.com. He is also the author of, and hey, this is a great title, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism. Welcome to the Dynamic Duo, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Morgan.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun here in the midst of this crisis. This morning, I've got to confess that I emailed my congressman. This is the first time I've done this in decades. I can't remember when I've done it before. But Ron Paul believes in his article this morning on lourockwell.com that there's some indecisive congressmen about consequences of voting for this trillion-dollar bailout package. He cites the Rasmussen poll where only 7% of the public allegedly would support this bailout. And then I heard a California congressman on CNBC this morning who said that it's 300-2 against voting for this. And just a couple minutes ago, I saw Senator Richard Shelby come out of the White House and face the media, and he said, we don't have a deal. So, you know, I'm going, hey, this is good news. What do you think? What's your political assessment about the situation?
Well, I'm more confident in the economics of it, but in terms of just the political outcome, I have a bad feeling. I think something's gonna happen. I mean, it's true some officials are saying we have no deal, but other ones are coming forward and say, yeah, we're basically now just haggling over the details. And I think that, I mean, they have, in Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke, they've got two big guns saying that if we don't act in this fashion, basically the world's gonna end. And so I think they're going to have a lot of cover if they vote for something like that.
What were they saying a month ago?
Right. You're like, why didn't they see that this was coming a month ago?
Right. Everything is a sound fundamentally. Whenever they say it's fundamentally sound, that's the time to be protect yourself, protect your portfolio.
And really, since at least 13 months ago when they started cutting interest rates again and the credit freeze had really set in, I mean, every measure they have
been
more and more
unprecedented.
Yeah,
August was when the subprime crisis really first broke.
Right, and at each step of the way, they made it sound as if, no, just give us this little bit more of unprecedented power, and then things will be fine. And they just keep saying, oh, wait, no, it didn't fix it. Give us more power. So, yeah, it's I think something's going to happen politically, even though, as you say, the
odds are they will pass something, but I've got to take heart in any foot dragging or hope that they can't get it done. This congressman from California, whose name I didn't catch, but he said if we don't get it done by Saturday, I think it's all going to slow down. So I was taking heart there, and he was the Democrat actually. So apparently they're having more trouble getting along, bringing along some of these Republicans. But here's another, we'll call it, there's so many ramifications for this, but one of them that strikes me was the language that the administration had drafted, and in particular how lawless this thing is. It's a complete, you know, forget about the Constitution or a judicial system or law. I love the language here that the administration drafted or Paulson's Treasury Department, quote, decisions by the secretary pursuant to the authority of this act are non-reviewable and committed to agency discretion and may not be reviewed by any court of law or any administrative agency, unquote.
Yeah,
it's staggering,
really
isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know, and I think we should try not to be naive here. I mean, that might be the I Love Lucy strategy, where you go and ask your husband for a lot of dresses, and then when he backs down and only gives you half of what you asked for, that's really what you were hoping for all along. That maybe they had to know that that was inflammatory, and so I think maybe they asked for that much so that now if they just get the $700 billion, they can say, okay, we'll take that.
You know, I wonder when they come in with this outer space type intervention, though, they do disrupt a lot of law, bankruptcy, existing contracts, and they do need some kind of order. Now, ultimately, of course, they can get five lawyers on the Supreme Court to go along with them, I would imagine, but they do need some kind of a freeboot type language to protect themselves. Well, let's go to maybe some other more economic topics per se, but one of the things, since I'm short the market through a couple of these funds like Prudent Bear and Pro Funds, and guess what? Guess who they attacked? And you've but the short sellers, right? And the first thing that struck me was what a convenient political scapegoat, because the first thing I note is, hey, wait a minute now. If short sellers are right, and there is a winnowing process here about who's going to survive long selling short, but when you sell short, you're borrowing shares to sell when you think they're high, and then you replace them later when they are low, and you profit thereby, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my point is that if you're selling when prices are high, You're reducing them or preventing them from rising, and then when you replace them, you're demanding stocks later, and that puts upward pressure on prices. So you're actually smoothing the path. You're diminishing volatility. Don't short sellers have that effect in the market?
If they're successful, you're right. So,
if they're successful, yeah, which we, of course we aren't
right.
Always.
And the market has built a built-in mechanism to weed out the bad speculators, the ones who bet the wrong way. They keep losing money, and eventually they should stop doing that activity. Just like in any other competitive arena in the marketplace, the best people rise to the top. And so you're exactly right that successful professional speculators, their behavior is counter-cyclical, that when the stock's overvalued, they push it down, and when the stock is undervalued, they pull it back up. And so banning short selling, it's just going to have the exact opposite effect of what the intention is. As you say, it's going to make stocks more volatile. There's also plenty of people who short sell who are doing that as a hedging maneuver, not as a speculative play. So, you know, if you, for example...
Right. They're in a sense, being conservative and trying not to profit or lose on, let's say, a commodity.
Right, for that, or firms like AIG that write credit default swaps, and they insure the bonds of other risky firms as a way of hedging themselves. They might short the stock of the firm whose bonds they're insuring. And so now, if they can't hedge themselves by shorting the stock, they'll be more reluctant to sell insurance, basically, on bonds of that firm, which means outside investors now are going to be less likely to lend money to these troubled firms, which is the exact opposite of what we're trying to do here. We're trying to make it more likely that people invest in these companies.
Now, so that leads to the more general idea that this intervention is likely to lead to results opposite of intent.
Exactly. This just puts a huge bullseye on the financial sector and says these companies are so in trouble, they're so risky that the government has prevented.
Bob Murphy's analysis on the other side of the break. This is a dynamic duo. Don't go away. My guest during the first hour is Robert Murphy, PhD economist and author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism. And another claim to fame is he's got a blog, a website called consultingbyrpm.com, or otherwise known as Free Advice. And I was just looking at that, Bob, and I see you've got a note here about Warren Buffett might be one of your readers. He decided to invest $5 billion in Goldman Sachs, no doubt after reading your blog post, which had the following statement. Excuse me. I heard a guy say on CNBC that it was crucial to save Goldman Sachs because it is a symbol of capitalism around the world. We have to choke when we read that. So that means no matter what, the Goldman shareholders know they can't possibly go bankrupt or even get bought out, especially by a foreign buyer. They are untouchable now. Well, I heard Buffett quoted on the CNBC to the effect that he was betting on the bailout. Your comment?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it just goes to show that what's happened now is in Wall Street, a firm's survival depends not just on their ability to read the fundamentals, but also, to put it bluntly, on who they know, on if they have political pull. And I don't, you know, it's, yeah, I don't want to go down too far in terms of conspiracy theories, but I don't think it's coincidence that Goldman's now one of the few firms standing after its competitors have been gobbled up or gone bankrupt. And the former CEO of Goldman Sachs is the guy engineering the bailout.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Oh, I like conspiracy theories. To me, it's so obvious that the politicians are the front men for the real permanent government, the powers that be, if you will, Wall Street and the City of London, the international bankers, you know, who bought all these people? They aren't doing this, and it's just such a fraud that now I heard somebody say it might have been our president, quote unquote, stolen elections aside, Bush saying something to the effect that Main Street is Wall Street. You know, we're just doing this to help you.
Right, and not that I would recommend this alternative, but as a lot of people are pointing out, that if the whole point is to stem this problem, then they could just, with a lot less money, they could just go out and bail out the individual people who are defaulting on their mortgages. And, you know, like give them, instead of food stamps, give them mortgage stamps, somebody joked.
Yeah.
And you're right. And you could go through and you could say, wow, I mean, that would just cost an astronomical sum of money, but would it cost more than $700 billion to plug, you know, the few holes in there and keep the system propped up? So, I mean, it's very suspicious that what they're telling us needs to be done in order to basically stop the world from collapsing is to give hundreds of billions of dollars to these very politically well-connected Wall Street bankers.
Right. And at what price are they taking these trash assets off the hands of these former masters of the universe? You know, in other words, if the devil's in the details, there's a lot of hell going on here, or will be.
Right, and you raise a good point there that people keep talking about, well, the government very well might make money, but if this is such a good investment, then how come it takes the government to come in and do it? How come the government has to buy these assets that no one else wants to touch with a 10-foot pole?
And whatever happened to, this goes back to the question of the law, whatever happened to bankruptcy law? You know, they give us this big bogeyman, and they give like one number that's kicked around is $62 trillion in derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow, you know, if this all comes unraveled, that causes a deep depression. No, it doesn't directly. The credit markets are kind of locked up already. But does that number mean anything, that $62 billion? You know a lot more about these derivative markets than I do.
Well, right. I mean, what they're talking about, and there are various things. For example, a big component of that everyone's worried about is the so-called credit default swaps. And so the problem is, the concern is that it's not just the firms that were irresponsible and bet heavily on the real estate boom and now they're caught with all these mortgage-backed securities. They're not the only ones in danger now. Now it's also firms that were issuing insurance policies on...
Well, these were really side bets, aren't they?
Right, yeah. These credit default swaps are side bets. And so the problem is, if the firms that were issuing this insurance, if now there's going to be a lot more defaults than they thought would ever be possible, they're also going to get hit hard, and there could be a domino effect. So that's the concern. But the thing is, it's the government's actions themselves that have caused the credit crunch. If you think about it, it's not – in order for the credit crunch to happen, there's two things. First is there's all these bad mortgage-backed assets that are out there. But the second problem is nobody knows who's holding them. So that's why banks are afraid to lend to each other. It's because they're not sure exactly who's holding all these bad assets. And the government's own policies have caused that outcome, because people have been dragging their feet for 13 months hoping for a bailout. So why would you be forthcoming about how many assets you have and how many losses
right.
you're going to have to take?
Well, yeah, and that locked up like the Fed funds market because one bank doesn't know if the other bank is credit worthy, right?
And
we know, like you're saying, a lot of these people have are belly up in all but fact in that they have seriously negative balance sheets.
Right. The issue is a lot of these firms, people wonder, well, gee, if they made bad bets, okay, why don't they just get rid of these assets, sell them off, and then the markets will clear and we'll revalue all the portfolios and then we'll move on. But they can't because a lot of these big firms...
But they're going to fail, some of
right,
them. They
right.
can't meet credit requirements, right?
Right, that's the deal. That according to the accounting regulations and so on, right now, there are a lot of...
We've got problems hearing Bob.
I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Are we still on the air? And I apologize, we had a technical problem there in that last segment and lost Bob Murphy, our PhD economist guest. We're talking about, guess what, the news of the day, the news of the last month as the economy teeters and certainly the financial sector is pleading for at least $700 billion. And before we lost Bob in the last segment, he mentioned bad debts and, in effect, no transparency that has produced a credit crunch. And, Bob, if we back up, what caused this colossal growth in a mountain of debt that grew, I would say, in a single name, Alan Greenspan? And if you do have this credit or debt expansion and accompanying fiat paper money growth, okay, you get your boom, but then isn't the bust inevitable? Isn't that what we're we've got the first stages of a major bust underway?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. It's really remarkable. If you go and look at the plot of interest rates, specifically the federal funds rate, the target rate that the Federal Reserve sets, once you adjust it for inflation, what Alan Greenspan did right after the dot-com crash is he pulled those interest rates way down to levels that haven't been seen since the 70s once you adjust for the inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there were periods where
the nominal rate, or the literally quoted rate, was 1% at the low, wasn't it?
Right, exactly. And that was the period when inflation was higher than 1%. So there was mm-hmm. actually a negative. In a sense, they were paying people to borrow money.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, I mean, that money, if you look at the monetary aggregates, then it fits lockstep with that pattern that the money supply figures, depending on which one you look at, grew rapidly during that period as well. So they were pumping in all sorts of...
They were pumping in reserves, right? I mean, newly created money, in a base money, if you will.
Right, exactly, in an effort to pump back up the asset bubbles that were bursting from the dot-com crash. And so it's really just amazing that Alan Greenspan was called the maestro and he had this reputation when really he just blew up the housing sector and then handed it over to Bernanke and said, there you go, there's a present for you. And it was like a ticking time bomb.
I don't think I would have taken that job. I mean, although maybe I should have. Somebody like me or you should have been offered this job. Because, then we could sit on our hands and say, let nature take its course. Back in the old days, in other words, the last so-called free market recession, 1920-21, the whole attitude was completely different. It was basically, it's like an electric power outage. It's an act of nature, an act of God. And everything is too high, people said, at the end of the Great War, including wage rates. And the thing lasted like 7 months, everything readjusted, and then you had the cleansing and the foundations for real economic growth. The resources are allocated to better hands, and away you go. At least for a while you had sound economic growth.
Right, that's exactly right. And it's ironic when people are saying this present period could be another Great Depression. And that's right, because during the Great Depression, what happened, there was a stock market crash, and then Hoover, then FDR did everything in their power to prevent the recession, to prevent the reallocation of resources, to prevent wage rates from falling so workers could get reallocated to where they were supposed to be. And instead, they just dug their heads in the sand and said, no, the economy will not adjust. We're going to keep producing as if it were 1928. And that's why the depression is
laughable on one level, but it's tragic what they're the results they're going to get from this.
Right, exactly. And as we said before in previous segments here, that you know this has already been going on for 13 months now, and this would have been ancient history if this had really been a free market response, and the government said, hey, you guys, you know, made your own bed, you can lie in it now. The markets would have responded. Some firms might have gone bankrupt. They would have taken huge losses. But firms, that's what happened anyway. The dollar already has gotten crushed in the international exchanges. And, you know, all the
bad
things.
And maybe you're not seeing nothing yet, depending on how where are they going to get all this additional spending money? Now, I would say, you know, Bank of Japan, Bank of China, they aren't even intimidated by our military might anymore. You know, the so-called economic warfare where you pick up the phone and say, hey, you guys are, you know, selling a lot to us, or we're funding you, like back in the Suez Crisis days, you know, when the president could call his British counterpart and basically use our economic strength. Well, that's really gone. The rest of the world is ahead of us in terms of perceptions about what a bankrupt empire we are. So. So that leads me to believe, since we have no net savings in effect, that Bernanke is going to have to step it up, you know, print in effect by buying most of this newly issued debt.
I think you're exactly right. And what's happened, what's interesting with Bernanke and why I'm almost sympathetic towards him, because I really do think he was handed this disaster waiting to happen that was created under Alan Greenspan's tenure. Well, Bernanke has, given that he's tried so hard to resuscitate the credit markets and the investment banks, he's actually been as non-inflationary as possible. And what I mean is, all these, you know, you see every day that these massive Fed injections of overnight funds into the banking sector, and what he's been doing is sterilizing them by selling off Fed assets. But the problem is, eventually they're going to run out of that. I think they've already burned through about half of
half of their net worth, their holdings, yeah.
Right. So the point is, you know, so now they got, like, let's say around $400 billion. So once that runs out, then the question is going to be, do you continue with this lifeline to the banking sector and then just print up the difference, in which case you're going to see incredible increases in CPI, or do you, you know, just cut the banks off? And I think politically he's not going to cut these banks off that have now become dependent on welfare basically coming from the Federal Reserve. So, I mean, everything about this is just despicable in terms of the traditional fiscal conservative rhetoric about federal dependency and bailing people out and changing the incentives. I mean, now Wall Street is...
Right, welfare for the rich. Yeah.
Right, and it's in the same way that conservatives understand that welfare for inner-city residents, not merely is it wrong because it's a transfer of tax dollars that's not, you know, justified, but beyond that, it actually hurts the recipients in the long run. And the same thing here. These investment banks now are going to become dependent on political arbitrary decisions rather than on serving their customers.
Yeah, and where's the all these old-fashioned virtues kind of pre-Keynesian have just been trashed, you know, about hard work and thrift and personal responsibility. One of my previous guests, Alan Stang, who has a show on a competing network now, as he puts it, you know, they used to talk about a do-nothing Congress as if that were a bad thing. What we need is do-something people. You know, in a free society, you have lots of opportunities. And, hey, if private charity must, you know, help some, well, fine. We need to do it that way, et cetera. You know, so in other words, there's answers for all of these social issues. But we're getting a clean shot across the bow now. If the public can't figure this one out, and I think they're way ahead of the elite, then we're really in troubles. But I'm kind of heartened by the public's reaction to they smell a rat here.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly that it caught me by surprise how quickly Main Street, as it were, is turned off by this, and everyone realizes, wait a minute, this is just a swindle that a bunch of bankers are...
Right, yeah, Bob Higgs calls it piracy. Yeah, it's so blatant, it's so open, and it's easy to recognize, and the public is with it, so they got to get it done in a hurry, I think. Financial heroin, more of the juice, that's what Wall Street wants, and we will talk about the personal portfolio. What action should you take according to Dr. Bob Murphy? We'll see you on the other side of the break. This is the dynamic duo with Morgan Reynolds.
Earthquake.
And this is our last segment to speak with Bob Murphy about the ongoing meltdown and financial crisis and bailout package. And before we turn to what you would advise our listeners to do regarding this whole crisis, let me ask you, we have this precedent of the Great Depression that you brought up on the other side of the break, where the Hoover and FDR administrations did everything wrong and turned a normal business depression, short recession, into the Great Depression. What about the other historical case, which was more recent, Japan, where they had a stock market bubble and then a housing bubble and then basically a long, if shallow, recession that virtually extends into today? What about the Japanese precedent?
Well, I think that might be a better model for what our current situation is going to end up looking like, because for what it's worth, I think that Ben Bernanke and the other people who are engineering this have studied the mistakes made by central bankers in the past, and they might be able to avoid those particular errors. But what will happen, I mean, it's a good analogy you bring up with the Japanese situation. My understanding is they had to recapitalize their whole banking system three separate times. That the banks, you know, so in other words, this bailout that we're doing today, I mean, this is, not only will this not solve the problem, it will make it worse. When you wonder why were Wall Street bankers so short-sighted and why they make such silly short-term loans, well, the answer is because they just got bailed out. So, you know, on the upside, mm-hmm. they win, and then the taxpayer eats the losses. So we might see more of these bailouts down the road, and that will just cripple our financial markets. And, yeah, it won't cause any particular major depression per se, but it will just hamper our economic growth indefinitely.
And so from a taxpayer's point of view, this is more of a down payment. You know, they always underestimate the cost of these things by about 10 to 1. And then furthermore, of course, this doesn't solve the credit crunch per se, in that, you know, bygones are bygones. You've got to look and see, hey, am I going to basically hold a lot of dry powder, ready cash, or am I going to search around for new loans or other assets to acquire? Well, let me ask you, Bob Murphy, my guest, Dr. Bob Murphy, economist, past Hillsdale College Association, and let's see, we have the consultingrpm.com blog, and he is the author of the Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism. What should our listeners do in their own personal lives? What should we do on the income and asset side? What should we do on the liability side?
Well, I think just a few general recommendations are, first of all, you want to get exposure to gold and silver, because, you know, with this financial crisis, I mean, the dollar is going to take a beating, and then just more generally, people are going to be afraid of intangible financial assets, and they're going to flock to real commodities, and gold and silver are the primary ones.
So that number one is get longer on gold and silver, including coins in your personal holdings. Now, this is despite the fact that you believe the bailout package of some kind will pass. We're going to get that big intervention, right?
Right, because it's sort of like an either way, and there's going to be massive inflation, because if the bailout passes, then the federal deficit is going to just be absolutely enormous. It'll be over $1 trillion next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even mean just the off budget. Well, if we include Social Security, I'm saying the official numbers they report in the newspapers could easily be over $1 trillion in terms of the deficit next year if this thing goes through. And so the government's going to have to resort to the printing press in order.
Okay.
To do that. And so, yeah, you're going to see huge inflation.
Now, that's going to be very negative for the stock market, which has performed badly in real inflations, price inflations.
Exactly right. So
should people get out of the stock market if they're still in there?
Right. I think they definitely, in general, people should get out of stocks. I mean, not necessarily 100%, but what they should, for sure should do, should go away from the U.S.-based stocks, because now the United States government is following the example of countries around the world and is politicizing certain areas that up till now had been fairly unregulated. And so I think in terms of crippling capital flows and economic growth, this now is going to hit the U.S. economy relatively more than it will affect other economies around the world. And so going forward, I think you're going to see a bigger hit to U.S. stock appreciation.
Okay, but I'm still worried about that because of the global interconnectedness of these stock markets. Of course, you know, you had big dips in China and Russia, for example. But, yeah, be careful. Okay, what else should people do?
Well, another thing to consider is, if you can, to try to have your debts be based in nominal U.S. dollars and then try to exchange those for things that aren't denominated in dollars. So, for example, if people, I mean, it just sounds like crazy and counterintuitive, and in normal circumstances it would be, but if you're carrying credit card balances and you can get a 0% APR for a year with just a balance transfer fee, it probably makes more sense to roll that over and then use the money to go buy silver coins, for example.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it does depend on that interest rate you'll be charged by a credit card, but a lot of them offer 6 months transfer balances,
mm-hmm.
six months of 0% interest.
Right, and so if you expect that there could very well be 10% increase in the price level, then that's a very good bet for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like, quote, free money, unquote.
Right, so I guess what the point is that people... And again, I mean, that's you want to be careful about what you do and not get over your head. And of course, there's a danger that
mm-hmm.
you start running up your credit card balances, you feel like it's not really money. But again, what I'm saying is, in a sense, if the Federal Reserve is going to be printing up money and handing it out, then it might make sense for some people to get access to that credit. And then
okay, yeah. So one, exposure to gold and silver. Two, reduce your stock market, your equity position, but make whatever it is overseas, typically. And then three, debt in nominal U.S. terms isn't a bad thing, provided you have a low or no interest. Okay, do you have a fourth suggestion?
Well, I would just point people to my blog, Free Advice.
Okay, blog, Free Advice.
Consulting by RPM.com.
Now, well, you know, one of the things, though, that comes up here is how bad could this possibly get? Now, I kind of think of this as two stages of, like a moderate stage of a real meltdown would be these guys could, for example, declare a bank holiday, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There could easily be a spread because the FDIC insured, well, what do they got? I don't know, $36 billion. WaMu, Washington Mutual, goes down. That could take that out. Then they have to go to Congress, right? And then, in effect, it's a roundabout way of they'll have to print more money. And ultimately, you know, I'm thinking you could talk about it. I don't want to talk about too much of a survivalist thing, ultimately, where everything breaks down financially. But we could really, as you mentioned, suffer a very extreme price inflation by U.S. standards. In other words, double digits is not hard to envision, kind of a late Carter era type. Banana Republic is the term people are kicking around. Do you see that happening, or is that kind of a 1 in 4?
Well, I wouldn't rule it out, and that's why the number one thing I said was for people to actually get gold coins and silver coins and actually have them in their possession, not even necessarily in a safe deposit box, because, like you said,
keep them in a bank. No.
Right, because if they shut the banks down, you won't have access to it, and that's when you need them. So
right.
I think people should be prepared for that, but I think they would ultimately just print their way out of it, so the system would exist. It's just the prices would be astronomical.
Let's hope we aren't, the United States of Zimbabwe here in the next 2 or 3 years. Thanks so much, Bob Murphy, for coming on the Dynamic Duo. Really appreciate your insight into the economic crisis.
Glad to be here, Morgan.
This is Morgan Reynolds on the Dynamic Duo. Welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Bear at the Boy Wonder on Monday and Friday and Jim Fetzer during the middle 3 days of the week. I am Morgan Reynolds, sitting in today as guest host for Jim Fetzer this fine Thursday, September 25. And the second hour, I am pleased, most pleased, to have two great guys on. John Lear, the retired airline pilot, and Joe Keith, retired aerospace engineer. To fill out John's resume just briefly, he years ago was a CIA contract pilot, and he's piloted lots of big aircraft, and I believe he liked the Lockheed TriStar L-1011 best, but we can clear that up. He is the son of Bill Lear, the famous co-founder of Motorola and of Lear Jet fame. Joe Keith is, I think his major was EE. We'll have to clear that up, too. We're going to run fast and loose, but I've got the men on the line here to clear this up. And one of his claims to fame is that he was the master of the Fast Fourier Transform, which was used to test and engineer the aircraft frames, shaking the fragility of aircraft frames, which so Joe says, I know a lot about what aircraft frames can and cannot withstand. And of course, that takes us to this one of the more controversial areas of the 9/11. Well, welcome, John and Joe, to the dynamic duo today.
Hey, thanks. It's my pleasure to be here, and I just wanted to tell you that it's even better because the Dodgers have clinched the division championship and a spot in the playoffs.
Yeah, so you're happy about that, huh?
Yes, yes. Now I'm.
Well, we'll see.
Of course, I live in Las Vegas.
Or anything? They've been in the playoffs for a while. I don't believe, have they?
You know, I live in Las Vegas, but I did grow up for the most part in Los Angeles, and you know, I was there when. They built the original Dodger Stadium there when they moved out from Brooklyn, and they had the I remember the controversy over Chavez Ravine,
yeah.
And I don't know whether that's there anymore, but it's great to see them come back, you know. And Joe Torre's got such a bum deal from Steinbrenner back there at the Yankees, and he's such a cool guy.
Yeah,
then they got
kind of proves it up, I guess. You don't need the Yankees to do good in Major League Baseball, huh?
And then they got Manny Ramirez in there a few months ago, and he has just made the complete difference. But, whoa, we want to talk about 9/11.
Hey, Joe, are you? Do you care about the L.A. Dodgers?
I kind of lost track of baseball in the last few years.
Yeah, I look
used
at
to
it
be
once
a great
in a while,
baseball fan.
You know, come playoff time and the World Series. Here in Arkansas, the St. Louis Cardinals are kind of the favorite team. Okay,
hey,
but they're out of it this year. Hey, I want to play. You know, one of there's various things going on in 9/11 every week. But I want to play something that I think is the most important thing that happened in the last few days, and that is, I don't know if you caught this, either one of you, but I'm going to get your comments on this. Alex Jones called in to the Kevin Barrett Truth Jihad show and did a kind of a number on the no-planers and the so-called space beamers, and I'm going to play a little segment of this, and we'll get, you know, Alex, of course, is, I guess he's the flagship show here on the GCN network. So let me try and dial this thing up, and we'll see what Alex says. And I'd like your comment. We'll begin with John once I play this segment from Alex Jones calling into the Truth Jihad.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, I'm out of sync with what you're saying and what the program is saying.
How's that? Don't listen to the radio. There's a delay.
Okay, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
You just stay on the show, Joe, and be live. You can listen to a recording later, okay? Here we go with the Alex Jones call in to Kevin Barrett on the Truth Jihad.
I noticed day one that the no-planers for Tower 1 and 2 and that the space beamers would viciously attack anyone who didn't immediately agree with them and scream and yell at them and scream and yell at me and try to bully me and others and then viciously try to discredit the key researchers that were getting things ready for peer review, which they did, the key researchers that were really on the trail that's now fleshed out with Kevin Ryan and all these other people. And Stephen Jones and yourself, I mean, this is bombshell with the thermite and it's just so incredibly, on target. Just every step of the research continues, and it's really waking a lot of people up. So I noticed that not only did the bullies attack everybody 2 years ago and say, you've got to agree with us, at that critical point when the establishment finally decided 9/11 was a big threat to them, they then attacked all the key researchers savagely, and then national TV kept giving them attention, kept giving and saying, and so now when I do a national TV appearance or I go on a national radio show, they say, oh, you're the group that thinks space beings did it, or you're the group that thinks there were no planes. And I would talk to these no-planers, not their low-level, weak-minded people that follow them, but I would talk to the high-level, you know, the progenitors of it, and they would say, well, listen, I had family that was in New York, and they saw the first plane, or they saw the second plane, or I had family friends going back to college who saw it. They say, shut up, liar. You're probably in the bed. And I'm like, well, no. I mean, there was hundreds of cameras that, you know, picked up at least the second plane. I mean, we can argue about where they painted up, like Northwood says.
Okay, did you hear Alex Jones' statement?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, John, what's your reaction?
Well, Alex says we viciously attack him, and I just like to remind him that he hasn't given me the chance. I got a call from his producer several months ago and said, oh, John, yeah, we'd love to have you on, and oh, great, this is a real honor and everything. And so I get all ready and get my schedule ready. It was a couple days later, and about an hour before the program, I get email says there's been some problem. We won't be able to do it today. And so, I emailed back, well, what's the problem? And says, well, Alex scheduled somebody else, and I didn't know about it, And but that was the last.
We found out what
I heard
about the planes, no planes, right.
Alex never called, never said, hey, John, sorry for the screw-up, here, we'll reschedule it again. Nothing. So
yeah.
He hasn't given me a chance to viciously attack him.
I have two questions to Alex Jones. One is, why are you bringing this up now? My suspicion is that no planes has gained too much traction, so he's got to come in and take a swat at slowing down this advancing view. And the second is, why doesn't he ever want to talk content? For example, he sidestepped your appearance on his show. I don't think he wants to talk plain, no plain content with John Lear. Okay,
well, look,
Joe Keith, your comment about what Alex Jones had to say.
Well, Alex Jones is on the mainstream media at least once a week. He's on that Coast AM, and hell, he doesn't dare say anything nice about no planers.
Isn't
part of his income?
They don't have us on mainstream media. I wonder why. Nickel Hopped, he was a guest here a couple of weeks ago. I guess you could call him, Crazy Nickel. But he knows what's right straight up on video fakery. But he said, he pointed out, look, the only thing the mainstream media have ever seen about no planes was that they had a vague couple of minutes with Morgan Remmer. And I have two guests on during the second hour, both really good guys, John Lear, the retired airline pilot, and Joe Keith, retired aerospace engineer. And there are so many things I like about these two people, one being no fear. They're going to let it go, and they have this rebel streak in them. They're going to think for themselves and not go with the psyops, including the approved doctrine of the 9/11 truth movement, for example, that Alex Jones and Kevin Barrett seem to embrace. And we got at least I got fooled by the crossover, and I think the break happened while I was trying to make a point that. It's not the case that the mainstream media have even toyed with the no plane arguments and evidence. The only thing you can cite was that I once upon a time did 3.5 minutes on the Fox News channel. That was the fifth anniversary of 9/11. They caught me off guard, so I improvised to give a view that fundamentally right, but maybe not as precise or as practiced as I would like. So this idea that no planers are lending ridicule, making the easy target of the 9/11 truth movement, etc. Virtually everybody agrees, hey, 9/11 was done by pieces of our U.S. government, probably outside contractors and some foreigners. It was an inside job. It was a false flag operation. But after that, agreement quickly melts or falls apart. And but I have to just laugh when Alex Jones, he won't talk content. For example, for him to say ridicule, of course, is the first weapon of politics, to just use this term, space beamers. Well, hey, the Twin Towers and some other WTC prefix buildings were just turned to dust. What kind of thermite, which is a dang welding materials, can do that? And to just for him to tout Stephen Jones, that I think I know what side these people are really on, and then just just go on viciously bullies and attacking key researchers. It's just rubbish. I think he's you could point to Nicol Haupt and some of his New York City colleagues on that grounds, but. I'd rather talk content about can aluminum planes disappear into a tower at high speed and not slow, for example? Where is the evidence of a violent collision? What does Stephen or Alex Jones really have, guys, to justify protecting the official myth about airliners going into these four locations, and there's virtually no evidence for that?
Alex Jones has nothing. Alex Jones is frightened of me because I bring experience and fact to the table. And I'll make the challenge today. I, John Lear, on this date, September 25th, 2008, challenge Alex Jones to a debate on the no-plane issue. My professional opinion is that no airplane crashed on 9/11, and I challenge you or your best researcher to tell me why you think there was a real airplane at the Pentagon, at Shanksville, or at the World Trade Center. I have 40 years' experience in building airplanes, flying airplanes, maintaining airplanes, dispatching airplanes, and based on that experience,
and investigating aircraft accidents.
And investigating aircraft accidents. And so, Alex, get off your butt. Let's go one-on-one on this issue and get it over with. Thanks.
Ain't going to happen. I fearlessly predict, John. I mean, this would be, one of the great debate mismatches in human history. He's a coward, flat out.
Well,
let me just say, he's a coward. Okay, Joseph, what's your response to all this?
Well, there again, we get his media connection. The guy doesn't dare say
to keep his curry favor with the media. He's got to go with this narrow, limited hangout fallback deal that, and when the first 9/11 story falls apart, they have this second backup story that the Jones guys and company are it's a protective, limited hangout. Because then they'll say, okay, maybe some Arabs or their agents put thermite in the buildings.
Yeah, well, Alex will sell out the government part. I mean, he's okay with that, and I think he agrees that no airliner hit the Pentagon or crashed in Shanksville, but he's got to go with the airliners into the World Trade Center, because if he doesn't, then there's a direct link to the media.
Right.
As a perpetrator.
And the media were in on it. So he can't be part of the exposing of the media complicity in 9/11.
Right.
Okay, now talk about a mismatch here. They've been trotting out this guy called Ryan Mackey as a NASA rocket scientist. Now, I checked him out, and he does have a degree, and allegedly he does work for NASA, even though I think it's Health and Human Services, something like that. But he makes the most incredibly ignorant and stupid statements on some of these things he put out, and just recently he had one on a lengthy one, which was supposed to be the argument to end all arguments, and I took it and I ripped it to shreds. And, of course, we haven't heard anything about it since then.
Okay.
Let me tell
listeners that I've put this up on my website, nomoregames.net. So if any listeners want to go to nomoregames.net, you can, on the left-hand side, click on 9/11. And the top article is John Lehrer versus Ryan Mackey.
And Morgan?
Yes.
One experience I've had with John Mackey. Ron Mackey, right. He doesn't understand what the word meld means.
Oh, meld, yeah.
He has a dictionary.
Explain that, Joseph.
Well, he said when he was dissecting Joe's Law that, what does meld mean? What do I mean by melding into a building? And, of course, you know, he's got a dictionary, I guess, and if he's a rocket scientist, he ought to know how to use one.
Yeah, well, I don't think he's a, he may be a scientist, but I don't think
Keith is referring to an article, Joe's Law, that's also on nomoregames.net, which summarizes the violation of the Newtonian physics by these videos, these fake video crashes of planes going into towers. So please don't go away. Return to the dynamic duo, the other side of the break. I am Morgan Reynolds, your guest host today, sitting in for Jim Fetzer. And I have two wonderful guests, John Lehrer, retired airline pilot, and Joe Keith, retired aerospace engineers, and these are brave, good guys. And I wanted to pick up with the word meld, which apparently created confusion in the mind of a NASA rocket scientist. And you can pick up on this at nomoregames.net, where we have an article by Joe Keith called Joe's Law. And let me read Joe's Law. Airplanes don't meld into steel and concrete buildings. They crash against them. Now, what is so difficult about this? People at NASA ought to understand that an aluminum airplane, I don't care what speed it's allegedly flying, going into arguably the strongest building in the world, the strongest tower, is just going to get totally violently exploded, just pieces of aircraft all over the back 40. So, you know, what's so difficult about this?
Yeah, and Morgan?
Yes.
Go ahead, you're also going to see after the crash baggage flying, people flying, broken aircraft parts flying.
Right.
And you don't see any of that.
There'll be 8.6 million parts flying. And all I want to see is one.
Yeah.
Just give me one.
Yeah.
One part.
Yeah, the Boeing 767, I looked on Boeing's site one time. They said there were 3.1 million parts, but, you know, that's a pretty flexible number. But there are millions
of
parts.
So I wrote Boeing, and I asked through Russ Hammerly, who works for Boeing in Salt Lake City, and I said, this is an official request. How many parts are on the 767? And of course, I never heard back.
Joe had that same experience calling Boeing. They never called back. And Joe gets a retirement check every month, so he should be, you know, kind of inside guy. They should be nice to their former employees of acquired firms, right? Isn't
yeah, Boeing
it,
knows who I am.
What's that, Joe?
Boeing knows about me, but they're very quiet about this whole thing. They're quiet. Why don't
they
come
know,
out?
Oh, yeah, sure. They're part of the silent conspirators, yes. They're not going to blow any whistle. Half of their revenues come from the federal government.
Well, they're the biggest aerospace contractor out there.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. There is something like $50 billion a year in revenue. Some magnificent sum.
Now, when TWA 800 was blown up by the Navy, and it was an accidental, what happened is the Navy missile lost track on a drone for about an instant, and when it picked up another object, it was the 747. It went through first class, and it didn't have a warhead on it, but it was enough to implode the to cut the nose off, which then destroyed the rest of the airplane.
And there was only one missile that hit it, huh?
Correct. And in order to cover it up, the U.S. government went to Boeing and they said, look, we need you to help us here, and what we need you to do is say that it was a an arcing of a center tank fuel pump that lit off the gas tank and blew it up. And Boeing said, no, we won't do that. There's no possible, first of all, there's no possible way for a center tank fuel pump to arc because there's nothing gets it direct in contact with any gas. And second of all, an arcing, a slow voltage arc like that, even high voltage, won't light the JP-4 fuel. So the government thought about it, and then a few weeks later they came back and said, okay, how about this? How about just saying that it was only on Boeing 747-100s, because, you know, they don't fly that many 100s anymore, so it wouldn't affect that many operators, which is what Boeing was concerned about, and just say that it was a center fuel tank pump arcing, and here's the icing. We will let you merge with McDonnell Douglas, which you've been trying to do for the last 6 years, and you will have no more problem. And Boeing said, okay, done deal. Well, that was how that finished up.
Yeah.
Boeing is a player. I mean, they're an operator. They know how to do it. Okay,
you know, we're seeing a similar thing with Washington, the District of Criminals, and Wall Street now. I mean, this is an in-your-face. The public, if they can't see through this one, this bit of piracy, they certainly aren't going to see through 9/11. But it's just so, the corruption is so wide and deep. But I think before 9/11 catches up with the perps, the bankruptcy, the decline of the empires may provide the real opportunity for a constitutional crisis before we were able to break open 9/11. Joe, you were going to say something.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, why doesn't Boeing, come out and just lay out the specs for Boeing and what happened on the plane going into the building? Why don't they come out and say something?
Yeah.
Well,
the silence of Boeing is a self-indictment.
Deafening.
They're guilty as all get out.
The silence is deafening.
Yeah. Let's go to
I expected.
Joe was one of the initiators of this whole debate over whether a Boeing 767 could really fly at the claimed speeds that are shown in these videos of, let's use the NIST number, 542 miles an hour. It comes into the towers. And there was a lot of go around. And now you have this recent article that we just put up on nomoregames.net. And to me, it's pretty dang definitive, speaking of silence. Now, this exchange between you and Anthony Lawson and Ryan Mackey, a research scientist at NASA, has never been commented on by your intellectual opponents. Is that right? They've been silent?
Yeah. That's correct, and particularly the last one. And I enumerated every single point and, asked in return, tell me if I'm wrong, let me know. And I haven't heard one single word, not about anything, not even the smallest thing that I brought up.
What can they say? We're exposed? That's
right.
What I'm going to amend your article by having an editor's note at the end. Why haven't they replied at all? Because this is just, taking them to the woodshed. This guy Mackey, for example, tries to distinguish between these low and high bypass. Well, actually, you do. He's claiming, that by indirect example that there's no reason to doubt that a Boeing 767 could fly at 542 miles an hour near sea level. And he says, for example, Mackey says, turbofans, that's the turbofan rather than a straight turbo engine, straight jet. turbofans are in service on some of the fastest aircraft in the world, like the F-15 or the F-22. And so what's this? These are much
but not with fans 7 feet in diameter.
Right?
What?
These are not the same kind of turbofan engines that you would have on a 767.
No, they don't have fans that are 7 feet diameter in front of the airplane.
8 feet,
but,
yeah. These guys are such
minor details.
I mean, that's flat out. Okay, we've got John Lear and Joe Keith, some great guys, great guests on the Dynamic Duo, so don't go away. I am Morgan Reynolds, your guest host, subbing for Jim Fetzer on this fine Thursday afternoon. And my two guests are great guys, namely John Lear and Joe Keith. John Lear, retired airline pilot, and Joe Keith, retired aerospace engineer. And, hey, there's a lot of things we could talk about that maybe are small pieces of the picture. And John Lennon says, we want a revolution, and in a way we do, too, or at least a restoration of the republic. And we certainly want to change the world. So let's in this last segment step back from some of these details and talk about the big picture and or do some strategic thinking. And my big question is, how are we going to win? You know, how can we get this thing to break wide open and reform the? We need a constitutional crisis is one way to put it. And I was talking about this issue with Paul V. Sheridan, one of the 9/11 activists who lives in Michigan near Detroit, and he made an observation about the auto industry. In this context, I want to see, is there any link here between the economic crisis and the 9/11 crisis or fraud? And he points out that in the auto industry, they're all what he calls money buddies. Money buddies. So during prosperity for the auto industry, everybody else's buddy, and we're all making money. But all that falls apart during hard times, and then they start to rat each other out or downing each other. And I'm wondering if there's some connection here that if one of these things breaks very badly, which I believe the economic crisis is going to do. Does that help us on 9/11 or vice versa? 9/11 does seem a little bit stuck in space, that we're not really advancing the ball a whole lot. What do you think, John?
Yeah, it was part of a big program, and I don't know how far they're going to go with it. But, you know, Alex Jones was on Coast to Coast, George Norrie, last night, and he mentioned this government program that I've mentioned before, where they're going to use holographs to fake either a flying saucer attack or something like that as an end goal to something. Now, I don't know what the end goal is, but to hear Alex Jones talk about that was really interesting, because I've never heard him talk about specifically holograph technology before.
Mm. Yeah, that takes us back to the whole issue of what really happened at the World Trade Center. I'm going to leave that live for right now. Joe, is there any link here between the economic crisis, or can we get anything out of this in terms of breaking 9/11 open?
Well, I think there's already a link between it. I think we got some scared politicians, scared perps. I think maybe the actuation of this economic crisis may be initialized by the 9/11 perps.
Initiated by them?
Yeah. I mean, it may have been sped up because, look, there's a lot of money to be made. I mean, it could be a transfer of funds to let these guys get out of the country. Who knows? But there's something fishy about the whole thing.
Yeah, I was saying in the previous hour to our guest, Bob Murphy, economist, that this is one of those rare occasions where I actually emailed my congressman saying, don't vote for this bailout package, you know, because I'm not going to vote for you if you do. And it's a bipartisan disaster. Bipartisan means the monopoly party, you know, reveals itself too openly, really. But I really think if we could delay this thing till into next week, the groundswell of opposition could really stop this. And the powers that be would really take a hit. That might help hasten some kind of a major disruption in this whole thing.
I think you're 100% correct, and I'd like to see that happen. But how in the heck are we going to get it delayed? If we could delay it that week, people have time to think about it. But as you know, everybody's saying, "Oh, we're going to go bankrupt on Monday." You know, Monday's the day. We got to make the decision.
I know those liars. Yeah. Do something. Don't just stand there. Yeah, you go along with this fraud. It's just awful. It's almost, it reminds me a little bit about the morning of 9/11 itself, right? Where they did successfully psyop certainly 19 out of 20 of us, but this time they're only psyoping, I'd say, 1 in 20. There was a Rasmussen poll that only showed only 7% of the public backed the bailout plan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I also pointed out in the preceding hour that there was a California congressman on CNBC I caught this morning who said it's running 300-2 against. So, and Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul, the brave patriot, he wrote an article this morning on LouRockwell.com where he said, "Hey, a lot of my colleagues are nervous about voting for this because some of their constituents are really giving them negative feedback." So, if we could get past this weekend, maybe this whole thing would fall apart, which would be excellent. I mean, it's such a ripoff. It's just so outlandish, and they're going to print money like crazy. You know, where what money? You know, here in the village, I live in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. The POA, the Property Owners Association, which is a quasi, it's a private government in effect for this village.
Yeah.
Well, they're in some fiscal stringency. It was all profitable when these assessments were rolling in the door. And so what do they got to do? They got to cut. You know, they don't have a printing press. They have to say, no, we can't afford it. But the Congress doesn't have the backbone of saying, you know, we're on a gold standard. We've reached the limit on our borrowing, so just no, go away, you know? Instead, they just want to say yes to everything until it collapses completely.
Well, of course, my expertise is not in this area, but I believe, like you, that if we could delay things for a week, that it would help a tremendous amount.
Yeah. I hate to see them all doing the wrong thing. But meanwhile, you know, we've got, I believe, let's go back to the 9/11 issue. We've gained a lot of traction on the no plane issue. That, you know, the truth is gradually being established and it's spreading. I believe that's why Alex Jones came out with this rant denouncing no planers as vicious bullies and all the rest.
Okay, now when he talks about no plane, now wait, Morgan, listen.
John Lear on his program.
Morgan, when he talks about no planers being vicious bullies, there's only two of us, you and me. Who did it? Did you tell him that? Tell him that?
We're getting technical problems now.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Hello, John.
Yeah.
I can hear you, John.
There? I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, John.
Okay. Morgan, can you hear me? I'm on a landline, so it should be coming in great.
Yeah, me too.
I've heard this beeping in the background here, but
yeah, John,
too bad we can't.
You can hear me, right?
Absolutely loud and clear.
Oh, okay. God, it's strange.
Anyway, what I was going to tell Morgan is too bad they're not picking us up is, there's only two no-planers, me and him. And so I want to know who made this vicious attack against Alex Jones.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're a real tiny minority. Well, I think it's spread far beyond John Lear and Morgan Reynolds, don't you, Joe? Hey, thank you both for coming on. We had a little technical problem there the last minute, but